Court is now in session. Please be seated and come to order.
Ready now for the argument in Hammer against Ashcroft. Mr. Bell.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Chad Bell, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, David Paul Hammer. Mr. Hammer is challenging a prison policy promulgated and enforced by defendants that bans federal death row inmates and only federal death row inmates from meeting face-to-face with the press. As the Court is aware, this is the second time the case has come before it on appeal. In 2001-2002, in an earlier appeal, this case reversed a dismissal of Mr. Hammer's case for failure to state a claim and remanded the case for further proceedings and discovery. That discovery never occurred. Now faced in the current appeal with a summary judgment order in favor of defendants, this Court should again reverse for three primary reasons. First, Mr. Hammer has presented record evidence raising a genuine question of material fact in regards to his First Amendment, equal protection, and due process claims. Second, the District Court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Hammer a Rule 56F extension for the purpose of obtaining discovery from defendants.
Could I stop you on the discovery point? I think there's some concern about the line between discovery into, say, the subjective motivations of the Attorney General, which could open up a very undesirable Pandora's box, and discovery into the question whether the officially stated reasons for the media policy, which maybe I'll call it that, might have been pretextual. And it would help me, at least, very much to get some sense of what you hoped for or what Mr. Hammer hoped for in this Rule 56F motion and what kind of discovery would even be permissible.
Well, Your Honor, what Mr. Hammer was seeking was some type of administrative record, what courts routinely use to review administrative actions and to determine, you know, what motivated them, what was the purpose served by them.
Documentary evidence, or was he expecting that somehow former Attorney General Ashcroft's deposition would be taken, or what was he looking for?
Well, Your Honor, if you look, for example, to citizens of Overton Park versus Volpe, in that case they said, we look for an administrative record. We look for some type of record because if we have a record that shows the purpose.
I have a question similar to that of my colleague. The question, however, is not what the plaintiffs were searching for in Overton Park. The question is what you are searching for. So if you could be concrete about what you are searching for, that would help.
Yes, Your Honor. We're looking for evidence that shows that this policy might have been adopted to restrict speech.
Now, what kind of evidence? That is, do you anticipate taking the deposition of former Attorney General Ashcroft, or are you looking for the underlying papers? This is a form of rulemaking. Usually the administrative record is the papers behind the rules.
Yes, Your Honor. And we are looking for those papers. I do want to be clear. We are looking for those papers.
Mr. Bell, can Hammer make his case that the policy was passed in order to restrict speech based on its content without deposing cabinet-level officials?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe he can. He can make his case by showing, for example, that through correspondence, through documents. In this case, we had a letter from Senator Dorgan saying, basically, after the televised interview of Timothy McVeigh, I don't think that death row inmates should be allowed on television for interviews. And a report, a newspaper article, indicated that the BOP responded to that by saying, yes, don't worry, we'll take care of it, we will stop these interviews, and then we'll say we did it for security concerns. So, for example, that correspondence from the BOP to Senator Dorgan would be evidence. Any correspondence between Attorney General Ashcroft and Warden Lappin, for example, on April 10th, 2001, I believe, there was a press conference, and in that press conference where they were discussing the terms of Mr. McVeigh's execution, Mr. Attorney General Ashcroft and Bureau of Prisons Director Kathleen Hawk-Sawyer, both defendants in this case, said that they were adopting a new policy.
And did anybody suggest that there's a security risk? Regular prisoners talking to the press that is different from the security risk of a death row prisoner.
Your Honor, I don't believe there is. The defendants, the only piece of evidence we have in this case of what the purpose of this restriction was, is a litigation-specific after-the-fact affidavit by Warden Lappin saying, we were concerned with the jail celebrity problem, the problem that the possibility that inmates, after being televised, would gain a certain degree of notoriety and then be able to exert that influence over other prisoners.
Nobody seemed to be concerned about the celebrity status of any other prisoner?
They do not seem
to be. A terrorist, for instance?
No, Your Honor. There are 200,000 inmates in the Bureau of Prisons.
What I find troublesome, maybe you think this is not in the case, you know, you have these people who murder for a cause, you know, like abortion, killing an abortion clinic doctor, something of that sort. The fact that they might become celebrities, TV celebrities on death row, wouldn't that actually increase the incentive to commit that kind of crime?
Your Honor, I don't believe it would. But
really?
The other point
you don't,
is...
You don't think it would? Why wouldn't it? I mean, if you're a nut, you want to... I don't mean you, obviously. But if you have some nutty person who wants to kill, not for the usual reasons, but wants to kill to make a statement because he has some strong feeling about some particular class in the society... Then he says to himself, you know, my statement that the murder will make, this will be amplified when I go on TV and I get to explain why I did this, you know, I'm a martyr and all that stuff. Isn't that something that we ought to be worried about?
Your Honor, there are a couple responses to that, and I would direct the court to Turner versus Safely in this case. The interest in
that seems to me a very different case. I mean, the notion of, you know, marriage and prison, pretty strange notion, but it doesn't increase the risk of crime, particularly, I wouldn't think.
Your Honor, but they pointed out there is a difference between restrictions.
But why talk about Turner? Why not just answer directly? Is this fear I'm expressing completely chimerical?
Your Honor, that fear is not a penological interest. It's an interest on what happens
on
the outside.
So what? I don't understand.
Wouldn't it be addressed to a nut to find out how he felt about it? I mean, it seems to me, just academically, that a terrorist would fall in that classification just as much as a murderer.
Yes, Your Honor. And
might cause other people to be terrorists.
And another point here is that the case-by-case determination that applies to every other BOP inmate.
I don't understand what you said about there's no penological interest. Aren't prison authorities concerned with the crime rate? I mean, isn't training programs in prison, aren't they efforts to reduce recidivism?
Well, yes, they are, Your Honor, but they're addressed to the prisoners in the system. It's not a concern.
I don't understand. I don't understand. Why wouldn't a responsible prison official say, I don't want a situation where, because of these TV interviews, you're going to have more of these murderers, these cause murderers?
Well, Your Honor.
Is that illegitimate if the Bureau of Prisons said, no, we don't want... We're going to create danger for the society if we allow these people to become media celebrities.
Your Honor, that very well may be legitimate, but there's a couple differences in this case. First of all, we don't have that record here.
I don't think you need a record. I don't understand that. I think that's, you know, in the domain of legislative facts. A restriction on free speech is reasonable if the reduction in the value of expression is offset by dangers to the community. And that's not usually decided on the basis of a record, basis of, you know, conjecture, common sense, so on.
Mr. Bell, I want to approach this from a different end, though. And for me, it requires distinguishing between the two aspects of this policy, the one having to do with televising, and the other having to do with the restriction on saying anything about other inmates, because the televising restriction does, as I understand it, leave a very limited possibility open for written communications with journalists and a certain amount of telephone time, although not very much. The content one bothers me in that I imagine if Death Row were unfortunate enough to have a Lieutenant Burge kind of character on it in the Guard Corps, or people who were behaving like the guards at Abu Ghraib did, the inmate might very much want to get the word out to somebody that there were abuses in the prison itself, and yet under this policy, there's no way that could happen.
Your Honor, I want to point out one thing. This ban isn't just a ban on the television broadcast of interviews. It's a ban on all face-to-face interviews. You can't record one. You can't even have a print journalist sit down across from an inmate and interview that inmate face-to-face for a print article, which arguably, based on Warden Lappin's affidavit, the only concern was with televising these interviews and these inmates becoming notorious through that television. So let me just clarify that point.
So in other words, you might accept, in response to what Judge Posner is saying, that if the policy had just said we don't want anything broadcast on TV, that would be a legitimate policy for the prison.
That would be more legitimate than this one. You would still have equal protection problems because you're restricting inmates only based on their death sentence and based on nothing else.
Well, you're doing it on their security situation, too. And you've got all the death row inmates in the federal system are in Indiana, and so you're just picking out one prison and you're not discriminating against the people that are there on death row.
Well, Your Honor, the security concern identified by the defendants was the jail celebrity problem, the idea that inmates would get notoriety and influence other inmates and undermining prison security. And as amicus parties pointed out, as we pointed out, death row inmates have very little interaction with other inmates.
Well, the other inmates, can they watch TV?
The other inmates outside can watch TV, but there's no risk that these death
row inmates.
No,
but I mean, if this TV celebrity mass, you know, murderer gives an interview and all the other inmates can watch it, and if he says something that's, you know, inflammatory, that would be a.
But not if it's not televised. I mean, if the real policy is no face-to-face conversations between a journalist who publishes in a newspaper with a circulation of 1,000, just as, you know, often Idaho or something, then the policy is sweeping much more broadly.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and even so, you know, Tom Brokaw or Charlie Gibson could sit down and have an interview that's not recorded and report on that interview to the American public to, you know, limit this problem. But again, Your Honor, I go back to the fact that every other inmate, all other inmates, including other murderers convicted of the same crime as Mr. Hammer, who, for whatever reason, did not receive the death penalty, whether it was because their crime was committed and they were convicted and tried before the reimposition of the death penalty or because they pled out, all of those inmates would still be allowed a face-to-face interview, are still allowed a face-to-face interview, and are still allowed a televised interview.
Let me bring this from a different tack. What do you actually expect to receive from the What's the lawsuit about? You want an interview?
Your Honor, we want the right
or
to...
Or delay the imposition of the death penalty.
Your Honor, it's the issue is the interview, whether or not we can speak to the
so
press.
So if we said you have the interview, then you put him to death, then, is that
but,
it?
But he's not under a death sentence right now, is he?
He's not. His case is before the Third Circuit on appeal. The district court in this case vacated his death sentence. The government has appealed the vacating of that death sentence and requested that the Third Circuit reimpose it. Mr. Hammer's asked for an entire new trial. And the question is whether he gets a new trial, new sentencing, or whether the Third Circuit reimposes.
So why are we here?
Well, because, Your Honor, he is still being treated as a death row inmate, and defendants concede that he is under these restrictions and that he is, for all intents and purposes, a death row inmate.
So he's actually housed on, at least according to the footnote in our opinion, which was reflected the information available to us at the time of the panel decision. His death sentence had been vacated. He's still housed on death row, and he's still under the sentence, although he could stay on death row for some indefinite not under the sentence, under the policy.
Yes, Your Honor, and the government has already indicated.
So you're asking for an advisory opinion?
We're not, Your Honor. We're asking for...
He wants to be able to give interviews. He can't give interviews now.
That he be given the right to be given interviews. The defendants have treated...
I'm puzzled by all of this. I thought the relief being requested in this suit was money damages. The puzzle about money damages is that this is fundamentally litigation under the Administrative Procedure Act. The argument is that the administrative record doesn't support a particular regulation adopted by the prison under standard APA approaches, and of course that's what Overton Park against Volpe is about. But how is it, I mean, under what circumstances should an attorney general or a commissioner of the FCC who votes for a rule later held invalid by the court be ordered to pay money damages? This whole money damages portion of this litigation leaves me mystified. The usual approach under the APA is one in which you get prospective relief, that is, let the man have interviews, not money damages.
Your Honor, we're asking, Mr. Hammer filed his lawsuit and asked for two types of relief. He did ask for injunctive relief. He asked for injunctive declaratory relief that this, you know, this restriction be lifted. He also asked for money damages, and the reason, Your Honor, is because he has evidence that suggests and shows that the government, that these defendants, adopted this policy specifically to restrict speech.
Well, that's fine. But are there any cases in which the Supreme Court has suggested that money damages are available against the author of an invalid rule?
Your Honor, there are cases
The three Supreme Court cases that deal with this question, Saxby against Washington Post, Pell, Thornburg against Abbott, are all suits seeking only prospective relief, and that's the norm. And it seems to me that you probably should have abandoned the money damages problem long ago.
Well, Your Honor, the district court never addressed it. The district court, to the extent that it addressed the qualified immunity aspects
of this. You have to decide what it is you want, right? You haven't abandoned this request for relief. But so far as I know, the Supreme Court has never in its history suggested that the author of a rule later found invalid by a court is liable to pay money damages.
Your Honor, it's not just that the author of a rule later declared invalid would be entitled to pay damages. It's the fact that in this case the defendants were acting in a way that they knew to be against the Constitution, that they knew to be in violation of
the 1983 violation?
Exactly. The Bivens action, Your Honor, that seeks money damages for the officials.
Maybe I should put this in a different way. The Supreme Court says that Bivens is not to be used in a case where there is some other provision for judicial review. One would think the APA would be that provision.
Well, Your Honor, I would concede that that might be correct. But again, this was not a finding made by the district court. And
this is not a question of findings by the district court. It's a question of the sufficiency of a legal theory.
Did the government ever argue this should have been APA?
No, Your Honor, they did not. They never brought up that argument either. And
so they may have waived this point.
They may have. And the other point, Your Honor, too, is that I want to make this very clear. This was not part of this lawsuit is the fact that the BOP did promulgate rules through proper notice and comment rulemaking that required a case-by-case determination. The defendants then ignored them and created a institution supplement, an inferior institution-specific rule that not only, did not obey those properly noticed and commented rules, but completely obliterated them, completely contradicted them. And furthermore, Your Honor, there just isn't evidence here. We don't have a record yet.
Why do you say that this is a content-based restriction on speech? It doesn't say that death row inmates can express, only positive views about the American criminal justice system. There's nothing like that.
So they can't express any view.
It can't express any view. And the good reason, is that you don't want to give these people a platform, whatever they say, right?
Well, Your Honor, there's evidence here that it is a content-based restriction. And
what's the content?
Well, the content is any speech by a death row inmate.
Yes, and that's not content, right? How's that content? You don't want these people to speak.
I would point out Police Department of City of Chicago versus Mosley. In that case, The regulation at issue or the rule at issue was a distinction that permitted labor picketers near schools but prohibited non-labor picketers.
But look, a prisoner isn't permitted to go to a stadium and give a speech, right? So, but you wouldn't call that a content-based restriction, would you? These people can say anything they want in letters or on the telephone, right? They just, they're just denied a particular forum.
They cannot say anything they want in letters and telephone
calls. What can't they say in a letter?
My client cannot discuss his case at all. His case involves whether or not he, he admits he murdered himself.
Well, obviously his access to the courts to litigate about his case. I mean, obviously.
But he cannot discuss the case with the press. He cannot call attention to the fact that the government, as the district court in the Third Circuit found, withheld the identity of inmate witnesses that had exculpatory evidence.
Yeah, but he obviously he certainly can advance that in his pleadings and in his various lawsuits and, you know, habeas corpus and all that.
But it is a content limitation in that he can't discuss the circumstances of his case with the press.
He can talk
about the weather with the press, maybe.
Yeah, and he can talk about, I mean, I guess in a letter he could discuss his own personal experiences on death row, but he couldn't indicate that the guy next to me was mistreated by a guard, or, you know, an inmate that he knows that doesn't speak English or doesn't write English has been mistreated, or call attention to anything like that.
Look, this seems to me like a different... We're almost entering a different world. The holding of Saxby against Washington Post was that the Federal Bureau of Prisons could prevent video and direct face-to-face meetings with reporters, provided that it allowed correspondence. So I could understand an argument that the proviso here has not been satisfied. But I have taken your main argument to be that the main body of the rule, the one prohibiting video and direct meetings with reporters, was the invalid part. But, of course, that was the part sustained in Washington Post with the proviso. So what is the argument? Is it the main rule is invalid or that the Washington Post proviso has not been honored?
It's that the main rule is
both parts. I mean, in our earlier opinion, we said that you were challenging the policy that I'm reading that prevents him from giving face-to-face interviews with the media and from talking with the media about other inmates. So whatever Saxby against Washington Post may say about the first part of that and the adequacy of the alternatives, there's still the second part.
Yes, and Your Honor, Saxby, I need to point out, Saxby versus Washington Post applied to the entire Bureau of Prisons. It applied to everyone equally. It did not distinguish based on the fact that one prisoner was sentenced to death and the other for the same crime was not sentenced to death. And if you continue with the rest of the Turner analysis in this case, whether there are ready alternatives that would accommodate the right, there clearly are. It is the policy that is applied to every other inmate, 28 CFR 540.63.
But the murderers on death row, of course, receive particular attention. There's a kind of morbid fascination with the death penalty. So they're not like other prisoners. And they would have greater access to the media and, you know, be more disturbing figures as media celebrities.
As opposed to a slasher.
Or as opposed to Martha Stewart or former governor of the state, Governor Ryan. I mean, those inmates who are clearly celebrities even before they enter the court or enter the Bureau of Prisons, if they're not sentenced to death, they can become bigger celebrities on the inside by feasibly giving television interviews, by giving face-to-face written press interviews. It just, Your Honor, the Beard versus Banks is very instructive on this. The court noted there that that the restriction doesn't just have to be logical, it has to be reasonable. And the fact, and I notice I'm getting my rebuttal time here, so let me finish this thought. The fact that this restriction is imposed on death row inmates for the idea of the jail celebrity problem, because they might interact with other inmates after being on television and undermine prison authority, is frankly just not logical or reasonable. These inmates have less contact with other inmates, are less able to influence other inmates than the rest of the prison population. And I would submit that this restriction is just not reasonable. And if you continue...
Prison might think Martha Stewart a less of a dangerous role model than some of the, you know, a Timothy McVeigh type person.
Well, she comes up with a bad biscuit recipe.
There's that. But, Your Honor, there's also drug lords. There's also mafia figures who are not sentenced to death, are arguably more dangerous than my client who committed one murder. I'm going to sit down and save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Bell. Mr. Himmelfarb.
May it please the Court, I'm Edward Himmelfarb with the Department of Justice for the defendants here. Our position in this case is that it's governed by Pell against Procunier and by Saxby against Washington Post. And in fact, any distinctions between those cases and this tend to favor our point of view here. For one thing, under Turner against Safley, we're dealing with arguably a more deferential standard of review of prison regulations. For another thing, there are even more alternative means of expression here. In those two cases, unlike those two cases, the prisoners can have telephone conversations with the reporters as well.
But they have a limited number of minutes. Saxby and Pell against Procunier, actually the court assumed that there were more extensive alternative means of communication. I think what's available to Mr. Hammer is
absolutely
far more restrictive.
With all respect, Your Honor, I believe what the Supreme Court said in those cases was that the prisoners there had two alternatives. The first was written communications. We have that here. And the second was communications through friends and relatives who have made visits to the prison. And we have that here, too. But in those cases, they did not have telephone, at least as far as I can tell from the
opinion. Why don't they want the prisoners to talk about other prisoners in their letters?
Your Honor, that policy applies across the board to all the federal prisons.
Well, I know. What is the purpose?
Well, first thing, I'd like to answer the question, but if I may, just a little introductory thing, that actually the policy is directed not so much at the prisoners themselves, but at the media. The media are not allowed to report that information. Technically, the policy doesn't prohibit any particular inmate from mentioning another inmate.
But could be outrageous if there were an Abu Ghraib kind of situation in one of the prisons. And I know you'll probably say there isn't, and I hope there never is, and so on. But we don't know that. We didn't know it was there either. And we've had problems from time to time. And I actually found it almost laughable that the government's brief has said this was to preserve the privacy of the other inmates when, in fact, the chances of abuse seem to me much greater.
Your Honor, the prison system, BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, is very concerned about when one inmate mentions another inmate. There are all sorts of slights. Inmates take great offense at things that may or may not have even been intended by the other prisoner. And sometimes they're intended. The prisoner calls a third party, another prisoner, a snitch. That could cause major, major problems, not just for that inmate, but for the Bureau of Prisons and managing its prisons. And, you know, there are people in the Bureau of Prisons system.
That's not what you said, though. You talked in your brief about the privacy interests of other inmates. And
well,
it seems to
privacy,
me.
Privacy, Your Honor. I think that's a pretty strong privacy interest in not being accused publicly of being a snitch within the prison system.
So what about the abuse situation? You're muzzling the press to talk about, to find out about abuses in the prison from the people most likely to know about those abuses.
Honor, I don't think that's correct, Your Honor, with all respect. What the press can do is go to that other prisoner and ask directly. It is permitted to do that. So long as
that other
prisoner is willing to talk.
Can they publish that?
Yes.
They can publish anything they get?
If you get it directly from another prisoner, you
so
can
what if
it.
The other prisoner has been intimidated by the guards and told, you know, if you ever let a word of this out, you're going to be really sorry.
And he refuses to talk.
And so then he refuses to talk. Then it's just not known.
It's not known. You're right, Your Honor.
So the abuse just stays there.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, on the assumption that there's abuse in your particular case, and we'll have to entertain that assumption.
No,
here.
I realize it's a hypothetical.
No, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that you're dealing with a rule that was set up by the prison system to deal with the wide range of cases And it's a really necessary rule in the wide range of cases. Now, it's
but
conceivable
the problem,
that there might be individual problems as a result of this rule, but those are relatively minor with respect to the larger
We would hope so, but I just want to say, I mean, and I realize that the glimpse of the prison system that this court gets is not representative, probably, of how the whole thing works. But there are instances of abuses by guards. You can read our opinions. You can, I mean, these things do happen. It's the incidence is not zero. So I think rules like this need to be looked at very carefully.
Well, I'm sure they are looking at these rules carefully, and I think that the informed judgment of the Bureau of Prisons Management is that this rule is completely.
Inmates subject to the death penalty housed outside of Terre Haute anywhere?
Only there are two women on death row who are not housed with the men in Terre Haute. And that's
but not at other facilities.
They are at other facilities, yes.
The women are.
The women are.
But there are no men at other facilities.
No, there are not. There are 48 inmates on death row.
Now, do the same rules apply to the wherever the women are?
This is a special rule that applies only to Terre Haute.
That's what my question is. It's limited to Terre Haute.
It's limited to Terre Haute. It's issued by the former warden of Terre Haute.
Are women less prone to stir things up than men, or what?
No, that's not, Your Honor. That's
been my experience.
I'm sorry, I missed that last.
Actually, it's not been my experience, but I wondered whether the prison.
Well, Your Honor, in all seriousness.
I was serious as hell.
In all seriousness, if the warden at the prison where those women are held feels that it's important to have a policy like that, that warden is fully within his or her authority to create a rule like that. What happened in 1999 was that the federal prison system decided it was going to house all the male inmates. I'm not even sure they anticipated women, but they were going to house all of the male death row inmates in one location. That was a special SCU at Terre Haute. And in doing that, they decided that they needed some specific policies for this specific institution, this area of the institution where they were going to have these inmates. And that's what the warden at Terre Haute came up with, and that's what's being challenged in this case.
Are they under 23-hour lockdown, or what security measures exist in that unit?
They are kept apart from each other. They're kept primarily in their own individual cells where they have individual showers and toilets, and they even have a TV set in there. They're allowed a certain amount of time per week for recreation, which at the phase one level where Mr. Hammer is, they're still kept separate there, but they're sort of independently together. They have eight separate recreation cells that are adjacent to each other. So when eight inmates take recreation at the same time, they can't touch each other, really, I guess maybe fingers, I'm not quite sure, but they can talk to each other up and down the line.
In recreation is the only time they get to.
No, there's another time that may be even more important. They're allowed to get together in a similar, smaller internal set of cells where they can talk to each other and help each other with legal pleadings. And those cells are set up so that they can actually pass documents between each other and they can talk to each other there. There is certainly that. On the other hand, it is certainly true that for these people on death row, they are primarily kept to themselves. Mm-hmm.
Is there a remedy that could be fashioned solely to this defendant, or is this we're looking for something that's...
Well, as I understand him, he's looking to invalidate the entire policy.
A rule that says that prisoners can talk to the media even if they are convicted and sentenced to death.
That's right.
They get the same rights that every other prisoner gets in terms of relationship.
But unlike the inmates in death row, those inmates out in the regular institutions are not subject to these particular restrictions, nor are they people likely to be of interest to the public and to the media.
Well, they're not the only people of interest to the public.
No, primarily, and each institution could make
I even
that
doubt
decision
that. I bet if you did a poll as to how many people know who's in death row, you wouldn't come up with five positive answers. But I can tell you a whole bunch of people that are in prison that get the attention of the press constantly.
But they may not, Your Honor, they may not be of great concern to the prisons as the people on death row.
You're saying in Terre Haute presumably doesn't have all the white collar celebrity people, Martha Stewart, and Conrad Black type people. They're presumably in low security prisons.
Right? Most likely, the people on death row have all committed.
No, I don't mean the death row.
But Larry Hoover, for example, who I guess is out in Florence, or Jeff Fort, or some of these gang leaders, you know, Larry Hoover was gangster disciple, Ford, I think, was El Rukin. They can chat away face-to-face all they want with the press.
Right. Nobody's going to be interested in talking to
is
them.
Governor
Are you
Ryan,
kidding?
Is Governor Ryan a Terre Haute just academically?
I beg your pardon?
Governor Ryan, is he a Terre Haute?
Not in the death row.
But he's a Terre Haute.
No.
I'm sorry?
He's a Terre Haute. He's a prisoner of some interest to the public at large.
He's certainly not in the
He's in the camp.
I can tell you.
He's in the camp.
Okay.
Goody.
Which is, and this policy doesn't apply to him.
Yeah.
Now,
I know, but the point is he gets the attention of the press.
Oh, sure,
that's what we're talking
about. But it's not a great concern to the Bureau of Prisons whether Governor Ryan talks to the press. It just isn't a security problem. Now, you mentioned the gangster disciples. There's a fellow in death row named Daryl Johnson, I believe, who is a big wig in the gangster disciples. If you let this man go on TV, the 60 Minutes, there are 200 prisoners in the federal system. How many people do you think are going to be watching him on TV? The management of prisoners in the system who are gang members is very, very difficult, and you have to keep them.
Well, and that's exactly my point, because it seems to me they would be equally interested in what Larry Hoover had to say. Here's one man who's on death row. Here's Hoover, who's in Florence, which is the maximum federal facility. They would be just as interested in Larry Hoover's comments.
I'm not sure where this man is that you refer to in Florence. My understanding is that some part of Florence is also under the same similar policy, that some people at Florence are not allowed to talk to the press also. But that's not an issue in this case.
But is the next step that something we'll see in a few years that no prisoner will be permitted to speak to the press? Is that what's coming?
If you're
working at this piecemeal, we start at Terre Haute, now we're in Florence, pretty soon we'll be in Wasilla County prison.
No, Your Honor, actually, with all respect, I don't think that's likely. In fact, I think that there's a different trend. If you look at Saxby against Washington Post, in that opinion, what it says in there is at the time that case started, the policy of not allowing media interviews applied to everybody in the Bureau of Prisons, everybody. By the time the case was decided, the Bureau of Prisons had decided to remove from that the people at the minimum security prisons. And the trend has been exactly the opposite of what Your Honor suggested. The trend has been to allow as many people as they feel safe, not undermining the security rationale, allowing to talk, because the general philosophy of the Bureau of Prisons has been to try to minimize the restrictions placed on inmates to the extent that that's consistent with security. And in fact, when this policy, this institution supplement, was implemented in 2001, there was, with possible exceptions of Florence, there was nowhere else in the Bureau of Prisons system where this limitation existed. So the trend has been exactly the opposite, Your Honor. I really don't think it's a question of working out a piece
just
of
out of
backwards.
Just out of curiosity, how does the Bureau of Prisons determine who are journalists?
Who are journalists? They're actually spelled out in here. Their definition, I can't tell you off the top of my head. There's a definition.
How about bloggers?
In the general policy. Well, I don't think they've taken that into account. I mean, that's a serious question, Your Honor.
It's a
very serious question. I don't think it's been taken into account yet.
A couple of bloggers on the court, so you can... So there are a couple of bloggers on the court, so you can... Careful.
Right. Do you realize what you've done here?
I have no idea what I've done here. I really don't. I'm sure I'll find out soon enough what I've done here.
My brother Posner. You're keeping him from a face-to-face meeting.
I wonder whether the inmates would like to have a face-to-face meeting.
I would like them to.
If they have a computer, they can go talk to his computer likeness.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I think I probably ought to address the issue of motivation in the Turner analysis here, because I think that may be why I'm back here today.
If a policy was enacted with mixed motives, some legitimate and some not, would that policy pass muster under Turner?
All you need is one legitimate mixed motive is irrelevant. All you need is one legitimate penological goal that's rationally related to the policy. That's all that the first prong of Turner requires. And in fact, the first prong of Turner speaks of the penological goal that's put forward by the defendants. And put forward means this is the one that we told the court we.
So if the policy was enacted both because of security concerns and because the government wanted to suppress speech that it found offensive, that could be upheld under
Absolutely
Turner.
It could be upheld, Your Honor. The second motive is irrelevant under Turner. And I think one of the ways that you can really see how the Supreme Court has gone on this is if you look at Johnson against California, which is a case that involved racial segregation in the California prison visiting room. And they defended this distinction, this racial distinction, based on security concerns. And the Supreme Court said, look, this is a race discrimination case. All race cases are decided under strict scrutiny. We're not going to apply Turner here. One of the justifications the court gave for not applying Turner is that the court thought that Turner didn't deal with subjective motivation. And I think that's a confirmation of what we are saying about the importance of Turner and the first prong of Turner in ruling out the motivation as an element under Turner.
But another way of looking at that case, I think, is that if one of the motivations is actually an unconstitutional motivation, such as deciding to treat prisoners differentially on the basis of race or perhaps violating whatever First Amendment rights remain in the prison, that is not just kind of an equal one more reason. You can't have an unconstitutional policy.
Well, Your Honor, every case, pretty much every case under Turner is going to be a constitutional case. They're looking at the First Amendment here. Turner itself is a First Amendment case.
Well,
Thornburg is a First Amendment case. There's always a claim that the prison system is acting unconstitutional.
Not always a meritorious claim. There are plenty of frivolous First Amendment claims that are raised by prisoners.
It's not a frivolous claim because there isn't actually the motive there. It's frivolous because, without regard to motive, it's frivolous.
No, I mean, there are many First Amendment claims that prisoners raise that, in effect, assert that they've retained more of their First Amendment rights than they, in fact, have. We know that at the prison door you do shed some constitutional rights, not all of them, but some.
I might add the right to speak face-to-face with the press.
Well, you would say,
one very interesting thing that I discovered on rereading Pell is that even the dissent agreed that prisoners don't have a constitutional right to speak to the press.
That's why I think we need to evaluate this policy as a whole, looking at what avenues are left over. I know you've argued that you think they're just as good as Saxby and Pell. I didn't read them that way. And also looking at the restriction about saying even a word in such an interview about other inmates.
I would say it does not apply directly to the prisoners. It applies to the media.
And so it's okay to have censorship of the press, in your view, under the First Amendment?
Well, Your Honor, that this has already been upheld. I mean, not that specific aspect of it, but preventing them from talking face-to-face is a form of censorship, too. And this is not the problem.
I don't think that's the same at all, actually.
I'm losing you here. The rule of grand jury secrecy under Criminal Rule 6, for example, is a perfectly valid rule. But if grand jury materials are disclosed to the press, they have a First Amendment right to reveal them to the public, right? The Pentagon Papers case holds the same thing. What Ellsberg did was perfectly illegal. Once the materials were in the hands of the press, it's fine. I've heard you now say several times, well, it's okay, we're not censoring the prisoners, we're just censoring what the press says about what the prisoners say to them. It seems to me you've got a major problem here.
I would say, Your Honor, if I said that we were censoring the press, I really probably was not the very good way of explaining it. What I was trying to say is that the press is limited in what it can say about what inmate A told them. If inmate A says
you're not suggesting that if in violation of this policy the press goes in and gets information about other inmates that they could be enjoined from publishing.
No,
that's all the Pentagon Papers case.
So
they could be prosecuted, possibly.
That
was left open in the Pentagon Papers case. Well, that's a case about prior restraints,
not about prior restraints. Yeah. The only enforcement mechanism here is if the same person or maybe his employer comes back and says we might have another conversation on the telephone with these people and you say, look, you refused to comply with these rules in the last time, and we're not going to let you do that. And you didn't follow the prison rules. That's the enforcement mechanism. I don't really see that as a major censorship issue.
So what happens if Mr. Hammer writes a letter in which he, and you said written communication is fine, in which he, page two of the letter is all about something that happened to another inmate. So it's now in the hands of a reporter. And the reporter publishes an article about that. What happens, A, to Mr. Hammer, and, B, to the newspaper?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that this policy could be applied to allow him to be sanctioned within the prison.
Are the letters censored?
The letters have to be, have to be sent out open so that they can be read.
That's, well, they're censored. Somebody reads the letter.
Well,
and if
sure.
it does something that violates your, just a minute.
Yes.
If it does something, says something that violates your rule, it doesn't go out. Is that true?
You know, I'm not absolutely sure about that, Your Honor.
Well, you ought to write it on the wall.
There's certainly potential because they're also concerned about.
Why would they censor it at all if they weren't concerned
right.
about it?
When you know, you have the problem with writing to people in other prisons. You have the problem writing to Confederates outside the prison. So, yes, they're going to be concerned.
The Confederacy one is an easy one, but so what this one. If a letter is written to a journalist and it's censored, what happens if that letter violates your rule? What if he's talking about another prisoner or some other? What happens to the letter?
I'm not 100% sure, Your Honor.
Well, what I'm suggesting to you is the idea that they can use the letter to communicate is spurious. It's not true.
I don't think that's right, Your Honor. What they can use it for not things that are. This is a separate issue that, Your Honor, you've raised, the separate issue of that separate policy that applies everywhere in the Bureau of Prisons, that that the press is not supposed to publish information that it did not obtain from the inmate directly about other inmates. That's a different issue. For everything else,
Can I take you back
yes.
a wee bit? If prison officials can pass rules that are about censorship and justify them with insincere security justifications, where's the accountability for BOP policymakers? There is none.
Well, Your Honor, actually, what happens in a Turner against Safley case is that you produce the justification and yours. It's an insincere security rationale. But you still go through the four-prong analysis. And in some of those cases, you're going to find that because it's an insincere rationale, it's not going to be justified under all of those rationales because either there's going to be some obvious alternative under prong four that could be substituted for it, or because that there aren't. If it's an insincere motivation, is what I'm saying, Your Honor, is it's an insincere motivation. It's not likely that the policy has been established for that purpose, and it's not. And in some cases, I won't say it all.
Well,
in
what
some
makes
cases, it won't withstand standard Turner review.
Well, forgive me, but what makes Hammer's case so interesting and unique is that he managed to submit evidence from which a reasonable trier of fact could conclude that the media policy is grounded not in the cited security concerns, but rather in the BOP's desire to prevent death row inmates from speaking publicly. So that's what's so interesting to me, for one, about, you know, Hammer's case.
Well, that is, each case is going to have its unique set of facts, Your Honor, but you know, what the Attorney General, former Attorney General, was talking about, I think, Judge Posner, I think you characterized it reasonably, is, you know, we don't want to let somebody purchase access to the podium of America, I think is the way he phrased it, with the blood of 168 innocent victims. You don't want these people to encourage in any way the commission of further crimes. Now, we're not standing here, we're assuming for purposes of this appeal that is somehow an improper rationale because we're talking about the relevance of motive at all. But if you get beyond that at some point, that we don't see that as an improper rationale at all. Now, there's no evidence at this point that it is in any way connected with the policy. The policy was issued by the warden at Terre Haute.
Can I bring you back to sort of the Internet? Some federal inmates do have access to using computers or internet.
Well, not here, not at the SCU.
I understand that, but how does that policy about talking about what other inmates say apply to people that can communicate?
Your Honor, there is a policy about internet use, and I'm afraid I can't tell you any of the details about it, and I would hesitate to say anything because I'm afraid I would misstate it.
But you think it's the same as for a written letter?
Well, this policy says articulates the means of communication that are permissible. And by the way, it specifically recites, the policy itself recites safety, security, and good order. And it says that you have access to general and special mail procedures and monitored and unmonitored telephone calls. And those are spelled out there. It doesn't talk about internet or whatever that.
Let me ask you a question. I personally think this policy is aimed at not letting death row inmates be glamorized some way. And that seems to me to be the real reason for this policy, and that security concerns are just some big leaf to protect the policy from attack. But if that is what you're arguing, what is the security? Because how do you do a television interview with a death row inmate at Terre Haute when you've described how difficult it is even for the people to touch their fingers to each other? How is it done?
Well,
or how would it be done?
Theoretically, there.
I mean, you need a cameraman. You need a reporter.
There are visiting rooms that theoretically could be done in the visiting room, and theoretically could be done by teleconferencing also. I know Mr. Hammer, in this case, has suggested teleconferencing, which doesn't really address the Bureau of Prisons' rationale. But, yes, there is teleconferencing equipment available there.
Do the death row and inmates in their visiting rooms have face-to-face contact with visitors, or do they see them through bars or something?
Face-to-face, and
as in movies.
Face-to-face. There's a divider, typically.
There's a divider.
Typically, there's a divider. Lawyers generally don't have dividers. They can actually, hand things back and forth. But typically, there's a divider. And by the way, Mr. Hammer was hooked up by teleconferencing to argue an appeal in the Third Circuit back in 2000. And it's very interesting to see what the court's reaction to that was, because at the time he had filed an appeal from the death sentence and then tried to withdraw his appeal, and the court wasn't sure that he was actually allowed to do that under the statute. And they hooked him up by teleconferencing to the courtroom. Now, I'm not suggesting that here, but I just want the court to be aware of that. And in that decision, the court talks about how capable Mr. Hammer was, that he understood the case fully, he spoke respectfully to everybody, and he knew the record really well without even using notes very much. And I think that goes to the other point about whether he needed counsel. This is a very, very sophisticated gentleman, not your typical inmate litigator. In fact, there are two people on death row who are known as the legal experts. He's one of them. He helps other people. I said there's a room where individual inmates can ask each other for help. He's one of the people who helps other people with his legal pleadings.
I'll bear that in mind if it ever comes up, but if I ever have any need of them, I bear that in mind. I said I'll bear that in mind in case I need legal advice, but I want you to understand, I don't think anybody up here really cares one way or another about the inmate we're talking about. We're talking about the principal, and that's the only thing that intrigues me. Whether or not you could say all these people can talk to the press, but this group cannot. That's the most intriguing
These
part.
People are all different. They're all in an unusually high security.
Yes,
situation.
But there are other high security prisoners in this system,
yes,
a number of them.
That's right.
And some of them with higher security than just being in a death room, because they represent a very limited threat.
Right. The general policy, Ron, just to clarify, the general policy in the Bureau of Prisons is that face-to-face interviews in certain circumstances may be had. Individual institutions, if they feel it's appropriate for their particular inmates, are allowed to issue institution supplements to change that with respect to their own institutions. And so, when looking at the Terre Haute institution supplement, you don't necessarily hold it against Terre Haute.
Could the warden at Terre Haute make an exception to this particular general rule?
I don't believe that there's an exception built into the policy.
I mean, could he? I mean, he...
Could he issue a new institution supplement that changed this and said
for one inmate?
We'll look on a case by case. Yes, he could do it. We'll look on a case by case basis. He could do that.
So if our decision related just to him, Mr. Hammer, and not could we limit it to just Mr. Hammer and not make a broad?
I'm not sure how the court would do that, but
Well, we could figure out a way to do it.
That's right. I think courts usually figure out a way to do things that they want to do. One other thing I would point out that in Turner itself, it highlights the fact, it says this, that there's no such thing as a lowest common denominator in the prison system. You don't require a prison system to apply the same rules to every single institution in the prison. And if you have a rule in one prison within the system, you don't have to have it everywhere else, and you don't have to justify it in relation to the fact that there's no such policy applying in another situation. And I think this is a classic case of that. It applies only in Terre Haute. It doesn't apply elsewhere, and Turner says there's nothing inherently wrong with that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Hillefarm. Anything further, Mr. Bell?
Yes, sir. First, I'd like to just make a few points. It's important that the court consider both two things. First, the posture of this case. This is here on summary judgment. All Mr. Hammer had to do to satisfy summary judgment was raise triable questions of fact. As counsel for defendant just conceded, after you do the first step of Turner analysis, you nonetheless have to go to the other steps, looking at whether there are reasonable alternatives, looking at whether ready alternatives exist that would accommodate the right without foreclosing it. In this case, he's done that. He has shown that you could have a policy that just bars the broadcast of them, or that, more importantly, that Mr. Hammer and federal death row inmates could be put under the same case-by-case analysis that every other Bureau of Prisons prisoner is on. Judge Wood, you pointed out that there are gangster disciple inmates out in Colorado that are not subject to this policy. But those inmates can be restricted from press interviews based on case-by-case decision-making.
I'm not sure what you think the criteria for a case-by-case decision would be. I mean, it sounds like the normal criteria would be subject matter discrimination. Here's a prisoner who's going to say something we really don't like, so we'll restrict him. But I don't see why subject matter or content discrimination would be better than a uniform rule.
Your Honor, one thing you would look at is whether past disturbances had been caused, past security concerns had been raised by interviews.
Well, that's right. It could be. It wouldn't have to be subject matter. You could say not that, but you could say how dangerous is he, how disruptive has he been.
Every common law prisoner gets one free security disturbance?
No, Your Honor, no. But, I mean, certainly you would look at whether or not this inmate had, violated disciplinary rules, been a problem to prison security. And in this case, Mr. Hammer presented affidavits from other prisoners and the fact that he had, before this policy was adopted, given interviews that had no security problems. He didn't become a jail celebrity.
But the validity of a regulation isn't usually determined by a trial type hearing. You look at, general considerations. You don't look at the character of a particular offender.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but again, here we're on summary judgment, and here we are with
no
record.
No, you don't understand. You don't understand. Summary judgment as a prelude to a trial is different from summary judgment as a means of determining the legality of a regulation or a statute. And you determine that legality on the basis of general considerations rather than specifics subject to the law, rules of evidence about this particular offender, this particular warden, or anything of that.
Yes, Your Honor. And what you do to determine that in the case of First Amendment rights or constitutional rights is go through the Turner analysis. And here, Mr. Hammer has presented evidence on all four Turner criteria. The Bureau of Prisons already accommodates the right for inmates to speak face-to-face to the press for all other inmates. So to allow 48 inmates, Your Honor, 48 inmates on federal death row.
Right, but you're making an argument, your equal protection, right? It has nothing to do with any facts, contestable facts that you might want to test by way of cross-examination, right? We know it applies just to these 48 people.
There are no facts in the record, Your Honor.
Right. So what facts do you want to put into the record?
What facts do we want to put in the record? We want to look at what purpose the government had in enacting
But this. That's not how we deal with statutes and regulations. We don't have a trial to figure out the purpose behind a statute that's challenged as a violation of the Constitution.
But you have to know what the purpose is, Your Honor, and five
Are you disagreeing with me? Do you think that when a statute is challenged as unconstitutional, you have evidence about, and the legislators are called and they're asked, why did you pass this statute?
Well, there's a difference between statutes, Your Honor, and administrative actions.
This is a regulation, right?
No, the regulation, Your Honor.
Well, it's called an institutional supplement. It's a regulation. It's a general regulation.
Supplement,
it's not directed against Hammer.
Well, as an institution supplement, Your Honor, it has to comply with the regulations they've already promulgated. And
yes,
Honor,
but we don't have trials to determine whether one regulation is, you know, authorized by a statute or consistent with another regulation.
Yes, Your Honor, but we at least allow discovery.
Is it your point, though? Is it your point that the trial judge didn't have an adequate record on which to make his decision, even assuming it's a question of law?
Exactly, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. There was no.
So it's
record
not so much a jury issue mm-hmm. that you're dealing with as the adequacy of the record before the judge.
Yes, and I notice my time's up, so let me just respond to that point and any other questions the court has. Your Honor, when we're looking at these under Turner, you have to go through all the steps, and the important part is five other circuits, Salhuden versus Gord, Quinn versus Nix, just to name a couple cases, they've held that the purpose at issue in reviewing a Bureau of Prison or a prison regulator or prison administrator's actions in Turner analysis is the one the prison officials actually had. And we don't have any evidence, any contemporaneous evidence, except what Mr. Hammer has submitted showing that this policy was adopted for an unconstitutional purpose. And so because
thank
we don't
you.
Have
Mr. Bell,
thank you very much.
Yeah. Mr. Bell, would you again recount the status of this case with regard to the Third Circuit, where you are there, and
yes. Your Honor, just to be clear, I don't represent Mr. Hammer in his Third Circuit case, but as I understand his Third Circuit case, he is it's before the Third Circuit on appeal. The government has asked the Third Circuit to reinstate the death penalty and have indicated that they will pursue the death penalty if the government does not do so. Mr. Hammer has appealed to the Third Circuit asking for an entirely new trial. The district court only ordered resentencing. And so at this point, Mr. Hammer is being treated, and defendants conceded this in the original panel discussion or panel argument, that Mr. Hammer is under this regulation and subject to it as a death row inmate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.